From WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. After more than 10 years of debate over genetically modified foods, the world has not moved an inch closer to compromise. If anything, warring sides and perspectives have moved farther apart. Tonight, On Point, the search for an elusive middle ground in the fight over GM foods. But first, we begin in Washington, where today the Federal Reserve cut U.S. interest rates a quarter percentage point to 45-year lows and suggested it stood ready to cut again if the risk of deflation worsened. A full half-point cut in overnight rates had been widely expected. I asked Greg Ipp, economics editor for The Wall Street Journal, to interpret the Fed's move.
Tom, I think the Fed went into this meeting knowing that they had to do something. They had really raised a lot of expectations that they were determined to make sure deflation didn't happen. They had seen long-term interest rates, such as on bond yields, come down a lot. They wanted to make sure investors were comfortable holding bonds with yields at these levels and that they didn't lose any of the progress they had made in recent months. The question was, how big a move did they have to make in order to hold on to all these benefits? Would it be a quarter or a half? In the end, they decided on a quarter. This has come as a bit of a disappointment to both the stock and the bond markets. I think that there were people hoping that there would be a more decisive action. This was a little bit of a gamble on the part of the Fed, I think. I think that by going a quarter, they retain the flexibility to go further if they have to, while at the same time maintaining a little bit of a buffer so that they don't have some of the functional problems that you run into with much lower rates, such as on money market mutual funds. At the same time, you know, it's a risk. I mean, they may end up wishing they had gone further, that in fact the economy's recovery is perhaps not about to happen as they've been hoping.
Still, Greg, even with the quarter point cut, this puts rates at the lowest point for overnight lending in how many decades?
Absolutely. It's important to keep our sense of perspective here. Even though the Fed cut its rate only to 1% instead of 0.75%, it's still the lowest the federal funds rate has been since 1958. When Eisenhower was president. By any measure, the Fed is being extremely stimulative in its effort to get the economy going here. There's a lot of evidence out there that the Fed's efforts are starting to pay off. As I mentioned, bond yields have come down a lot, mortgage rates have plunged, everybody's out refinancing, the housing market is on fire. We just learned today that new home sales hit an all-time record in the month of May. The dollar has dropped a lot. That will be a big help to exporters, and by the way, it will also help reduce the risk of deflation because it makes imports more expensive. The stock market is up a lot. I'm not sure what the stock market is looking at that it deserves to be up so much, but it is up, and I'll take that. Thank you very much.
And yet, Greg, the Fed said today that the economy, while it's stabilized somewhat, said has yet to exhibit sustainable growth.
Yes, I think what the Fed is doing here, Tom, is telling us that they see positive signs out there. The job market has stabilized, that there are some signs that demand is picking up. But they don't want us to get the impression that they're running out there all Pollyannish saying the recovery is here, the recovery is here. They do want to assure us that they know there are a lot of risks out there. And that's why I say that I think implicit in this announcement today is the willingness to go and cut rates again if need be.
Greg, how low could rates go if the Fed had to go to the wall? What is the wall?
That's a question that people at the Fed are scratching their heads over right now. We don't really know how low they can go, but we do know that the lower they get, the more problems they occur. For example, a lot of money market mutual funds need at least 0.75% return on treasury bills just to cover their expenses. Below that, they can't really pay a return to their investors. As you go even lower, you have other problems. For example, some rates in the money market, such as particularly complex securities, are supposed to trade below the federal funds rate. Those types of products get all screwed up if the federal funds rate goes to zero, for example.
And when the Fed's overnight rate is at 1%, what are the implications for other kinds of interest rates, mortgage rates, loans?
For other interest rates, especially on mortgages, it's less important that the federal funds rate is 1% than the fact that it will probably be there for a very long time. And that means long-term interest rates are likely to come down a lot. And that means mortgage rates are likely to, if not come down more, at least stay down near these levels for a very long time. There are some short-term borrowing rates that ought to respond to this lower federal funds rate, such as the prime rate. Hasn't happened today yet. Maybe banks are fighting harder to hold on to their profit margins.
And what about the deflation threat? Does the Fed's willingness to go with just a quarter point cut instead of half a point mean that it's not so terribly worried about deflation after all?
Well, Tom, again, remember, a month and a half ago, we didn't know whether the Fed was going to cut rates at all. So from the perspective of 6 weeks ago, the fact that they cut rates today, I think, suggests that they take the threat of deflation very seriously indeed. no, they don't take it so seriously that they felt they had to go half a percentage point. Perhaps one of the reasons is because we learned last week that prices actually popped higher in May, a bit more than people were expecting. So perhaps deflation is, in fact, a much smaller risk than some people have been worrying. But again, I think part of the strategy here by the Fed is to give us the assurance that they will cut rates again if necessary, and at a minimum, hold rates at these levels for a very long time to make sure that deflation does not happen in this country.
And already the lowest overnight rate since 1958, that's a piece of history. Greg Ipp, thanks for joining us.
All right, Tom.
Greg Ipp is economics editor for the Wall Street Journal. He spoke with me from Washington. This week, the battle over genetically modified food raged from coast to coast in Washington at the Bio 2003 convention. President Bush accused Europe of ignoring the plight of starving Africans by blocking trade in GM foods.
Acting on unfounded, unscientific fears, many European governments have blocked the import of all new biotech crops. For the sake of a continent threatened by famine, I urge the European governments to end their opposition to biotechnology.
And in Sacramento, California, protesters rallied against biotech industry giants at the first ministerial conference and expo on agricultural science and technology.
We want to have control of our own food. GMOs are not tested. We don't know what happens to them. Organic food is much higher in nutrients, has more minerals, better for the environment.
To opponents, genetically modified organisms like herbicide-resistant corn are frankenfood, spread with strong-arm tactics by profit-hungry multinationals. To the scientists and business execs pushing the bounds of genetic intervention, biotechnology offers hope and full stomachs to a crowded, hungry world. And profits mean the chance for more and better research. Is there a healthy middle ground in the fight over genetically modified foods? Has the debate been taken hostage by wild greens and industry steamrollers? Or is this a battle that must be fought? You can join the conversation tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining us tonight from New York is science writer Peter Pringle, author of Food, Inc., Mendel to Monsanto, The Promises and Perils of the Biotech Harvest. Good evening and welcome, Peter Pringle.
Good evening, Tom. Good to be with you.
Good to have you. Thanks so much for joining us. Also with me in the studio tonight is On Point News analyst Jack Beatty, senior editor at the Atlantic Monthly. Hello, Jack. Good to
Hello,
have you
Tom.
Here.
Hello, Tom. Hello, Peter.
Hello, Jack. How are you?
You're much missed.
Peter what? Pringle, you've got a relationship here, and we love it, and you've got a big book out on GM food, and you're putting yourself forward as Dr. Moderation here, as Mr. Middle Ground. You say there is one, and we've got to get to it. But I wonder if you'd be good enough before we plunge into the debate, because we know it's a hot one, and we're going to throw some advocates up against you tonight who may not agree with your assessment. But first, in the United States today, how important is genetically modified food already? For our listeners tonight, how much are they likely to consume on a daily, weekly, monthly basis? How big a part of diets is GM food already?
Lots. In 1996, a few million acres worldwide were planted with GM crops. Now it's 120, 130 million, and 70% of that is in the United States. That goes into processed foods, cornflakes, taco bells, chips, that sort of thing. So you eat it all the time, although you don't see it and you don't know it because it's not labeled.
So, and of course, that in itself is one of the issues. And almost every phrase you've uttered there, as I listened, has got an issue embedded in it. Passions are so high around GM food, Peter Pringle. Why so high? And is there really a middle ground here?
Well, you know Jim Hightower, our friend, the famous former Texas agriculture commissioner,
Secretary.
I think he called himself.
Yes,
that's right. He said, there's nothing in the middle of the road except for dead armadillos and yellow lines. And, of course, he's absolutely right. But I did think that in this debate, it's really worth going down the middle. On the one hand, you have environmental groups who are insisting that they were frankenfoods, that they could cause allergies in humans and mutations in pests. And superweeds. And then on the other hand, you had Monsanto and the large agribusiness companies who were simply telling you, shut up and eat your cornflakes. So let's go down the middle. I think there is a middle ground. I think that there are causes for concern. There's a lot for the public to worry about. We should think about those allergies. We should think about the environment. But we should also think about the possibility that we might be able to create a plant that would grow in Africa, in an arid climate, in a swamp in Asia, where it couldn't grow before. And if that's possible, then we should do it.
And are you then discounting the whole Frankenfood critique? I mean, it's a cartoonish label, but the concern behind it is that we just don't really know what the full implications are when you start messing around with the very genetic structure of fundamental food staples that the humankind and the rest of life on Earth depend on.
Well, we don't know, of course, but actually Frankenfoods are not really any more Frankenfoods than a person with a transplanted heart is today's Frankenstein. We do have to worry, however. I mean, if you're taking an alien gene and you're sticking it into a genome where it's not known before, the genome feels uncomfortable. It looks at this alien gene and says, what are you doing here? We're not quite sure where to put you. Well, perhaps we'll put you up there. Whoops. Oh, that doesn't quite work. We'll put you down there. So there isn't any precision in this. There isn't the precision that the industry would like us to believe. So some things could happen, and that's the fundamental basis of the problem between Europe and the United States. And at the beginning of the program, we heard President Bush saying, accusing the Europeans of unfounded and unscientific fears, and propounding those to Africans and making them reject U.S. food aid that was genetically modified.
As Zambia did last year, said, no thanks, we won't take it.
Last year, that's right, exactly. But hang on a minute. There are two very different approaches from Europe and from the United States. The United States looked at this, these new foods and said, a tomato, if it looks like a tomato, it tastes like a tomato, then it is a tomato. It doesn't really matter how you produce it, whether you put an alien gene in there to make it grow bigger or better or stronger or whatever. The end product is a tomato. The Europeans looked at it and then they said that was substantially equivalent.
That's the phrase, substantial equivalence.
That's right, the doctrine of substantial equivalence. And then the Europeans looked at it and they said, hang on a minute, let's adopt something else, and we're going to call it the precautionary principle. It's a well-known principle in science. What it basically says is that if there's anything that could possibly go wrong along the line here, let's see if we can't preempt it and test it so that what we're going to eat at the end of the day, we can be more sure than if we adopt something like the substantial equivalence.
We tend to use this approach with medicine, with drugs. Why not with food?
Yeah, exactly.
Well, it's a question.
The substantial equivalence doctrine came about in the Reagan-Bush, first Bush administration. It was the beginning of the era of deregulation. They wanted to launch this science, launch this revolution in genetically modified foods. And I'm not saying that they skimped and scraped about that, but they actually did allow something that the Europeans did not allow. And I think there is a very good case for going back and looking at those rules again and starting over.
And the U.S. was off to the races. Jack Beattie, Peter Pringle, it seems like he'd like us to split the difference on this issue. But as you know, there are parties on both sides who are not interested in splitting the difference here.
No, it's like splitting the difference of a substantial equivalent of a tomato. That's a tomato, Peter. Sorry. Forgive me. But you know, I can imagine a dystopic novelist 60 years on talking about us sitting down to our substantial equivalents of tomatoes and our substantial equivalents of steaks and talking about the African country that 40 years ago took in this seed. And, you know, this seed was owned by a company, and the company essentially got a lock on life that way, on the staple crops of the company, of the country. And pretty soon, the local agriculture went into destitute, and pretty soon, people in that country were essentially the ultimate victims of a kind of botanic imperialism.
And there is the fear. We're going to test you, Peter Pringle, on your principle tonight. We're talking about the global battle over genetically modified food and the future of what you eat. Do you feel like you know what you're eating anymore? Is there a healthy middle ground here? You can join us at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about the global battle over genetically modified food and the future of what you eat. Amid all the charges and PR, what's going on with our food? You can join the conversation tonight. Has the debate here been taken hostage by wild greens and industry steamrollers? Are you ready to believe that a little fish gene in your strawberries might be a good thing? Or are you a food purist, an organic-only eater? How do you sort out the science, the profits, and the politics here? You can join us at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Our guest tonight is Peter Pringle. He's author of the new book, Food, Inc., and he makes the argument that there is a middle ground between the warring factions over GM food. Others are definitely not so sure. One of them joins us now. Anuradha Mittal is co-director of Food First, the Institute for Food Development Policy. She's co-editor of Voices of the South, a joint report with the Pesticide Action Network. She joins us from Oakland, California. Good evening and welcome, Anuradha Mittal.
Good evening.
Thanks so much for joining us. Anuradha, we're wading into this. We know you've been at the big convention in Sacramento this week. There's lots of tension there. We read about Monsanto rolling out new breeds of cotton, all kinds of new food laid out in the booths on display. Come here, buy this. Peter Pringle says, let's all settle down here a minute and find a kind of a reasonable middle ground. Does that siren song work for you?
Well, actually, that song does not work for me for a simple reason, because I'm still waiting for some decent rationale to be presented by the industry as to why we need genetic engineering of a food system. The argument that I've heard over and over again, not just this weekend, but in the, you know, throughout by the corporations, and then when U.S. took the Europe to the WTO around its ban on GM foods, is one of, this is starving Africans and Asians, especially Africans, because they're starving, we can increase food production. And nobody seems to be paying attention to the myth that we have enough food to provide 4.3 pounds of food per person per day around the world.
So you're saying it's just a distribution problem, so never mind the technology?
Hunger in the third world is a very complex phenomenon. And it is not just distribution. For example, my own country, India, which is home to almost 380 million people who are starving among the 800 million people in the developing world who are, according to FAO, are food insecure. 380 million are in my country, and yet India is the third largest producer of food. And in year 2000, while we had excess 80 million tons of food grains rotting in the granaries of Food Corporation of India, instead of distributing them through the public distribution system, Indian government was looking for export markets.
Okay, well, we're going to drive on into this with you, but I want to put that point to Peter Pringle. Peter Pringle, very basic critique here, says what we have is a distribution problem, not a technology problem. Why are we riding off on the wild biotech horse? How do you respond?
I don't disagree with it at all. Sure, there's a distribution problem, but there's also a problem of, for example, in Africa, where a parasitic weed of the genus Striga, or witchweed, inserts a sort of underground hypodermic into the roots of corn and sorghum, sucking off water and nutrients. On the tiny farms of sub-Saharan Africa, 100 million people lose some or all of their crops to Striga. Now, there is a genetically modified defense against this scourge available somewhere by a company, but it has yet to develop it. If it's possible that you could do something through genetic engineering, I don't see that there should be an objection to it. It is a, you know, food production is indeed, as Anurag says, a complex phenomenon, and it requires complex solutions. And I just wouldn't close the door, as she seems to be wanting to do.
Anuradha Mittal, let's plunge on in there. Of course, the world's never a perfect place. Mm-hmm. Distribution's never perfect. If you could deliver seeds to a farmer in sub-Saharan Africa or in southern India, that would help them on their own local plot come up with a better crop that would feed their family better, maybe give them some cash on the side, why not do it?
Well, the biggest problem with genetic engineering is that we have focused all our research agendas. We have put all our eggs in one basket. This is a case that I hear again all the time of this weed in Africa, whereas in my work with the communities on the ground, and I work with farmers around the world, in Africa they have their own local indigenous solutions to it, which are far more cheaper, which protect our biodiversity. So my problem with genetic engineering is that when we look at the expenses that are being made in order to promote this technology, and we put it against the alternatives that are already available and do a simple cost-benefit analysis, it is very obvious which way we need to go. We have seen that with these pharmaceutical genetically engineered crops such as vitamin A rice, when we are not recognizing that when people are too poor to have a decent meal, that causes vitamin A deficiency, and they have other deficiencies too. So a real fix would actually be ensuring people have living wage jobs, there's genuine access and control over food producing resources, rather than trying to find a quick technological fix and find that all our research agendas are being dictated by one technology, completely ignoring the indigenous knowledge, the systems of knowledge that have existed in our communities and among the farming communities. And also, there's no funding for other alternatives that do exist.
All right, let's toss that one back to Peter. Peter Pringle, you know that the United States, Washington, is looking to biotechnology as the next massive wave, a wave that might power the U.S. economy and others for a century or more here. So there is a powerful profit motive here. Anuradha Mittal suggests, as I hear her, that is blinding people to dangers and to alternatives, simpler, cheaper, organic alternatives.
It's true that biotechnology, bioengineering, agriculture took off on absolutely the wrong foot. Europe rebelled against it. Europeans remain against it and may continue to be against it. I mean, you know, if you live in Europe, you don't go around seeing underfed people in Europe. Nor do you see underfed people here. So you may say, why does the industrial north need this thing? Actually, it doesn't. And I also appreciate what Ms. Mattel is saying, to get a distribution system working to empower poor people to be able to buy the food that's available. That's Amartya Sen's argument. It's been around for an extremely long time, and it's perfectly correct. But I don't know why you can't slip in this other possibility here. I'm not suggesting simply biotechnology. I'm not suggesting simply that it's going to be a silver bullet. It certainly is not, and that was wrongly promoted by the biotech companies to be that. But it could help. And I think we shouldn't just blind ourselves and say, I haven't seen anything yet, therefore I don't really want to see anything.
Anuradha Mittal,
there are other things to fix.
Anuradha, I've just got you for another minute here. Then let me ask, you've got a fierce position and you defend it well, but is there room from where you stand on the green side of this equation to toe dip here, to judiciously use some of this biotechnology to improve the lot of farmers, of people around the world?
Well, first of all, I would say in terms of we have to look at who has to gain. Mr. Pringle talks about there are no underfed people in U.S. I would just like to point out that in 98, according to USDA, there were over 36 million Americans who were food insecure. And that number has drastically grown since then as we see our economy face one of its worst slumps. At the same time, you have corporations like Monsanto, whose stocks are half the price in December last year compared to what they were in January. So U.S. corporations and United States has a lot to gain from promotion of this biotechnology. So let's dismantle the myth. It is all being done for the third world, and there are some potential benefits. And to answer your question, it would be in terms of if we see those benefits, we have to see what those really are. Do we really see a corporate-free agenda? Do we really see our regulatory agencies working? More important, can we allow the third world and different countries and consumers to decide for themselves rather than it being shoved down our throats through intimidation and other tactics that we're seeing around us? So if it is really such a wonderful technology, people would adopt it. So it should really be left to the people, to the scientists, to the regulatory agencies, free of corporate control, rather than saying there must be some benefit in it. Because we have been saying organic, agroecological agriculture has tons of benefits, and nobody has paid any attention or put any research funding into it.
Anuradha Mittal, you fly the flag with a lot of verve, and we thank you for joining us tonight. Thanks for coming on.
Thank you.
Anuradha Mittal is co-director of Food First, the Institute for Food Development Policy. Well, Jack, we're seeing the bones of this laid out here. On the one side, advantages, practically described advantages, maybe with some risks. And Peter Pringle says from the middle of the road he can see room to be more careful about how it's pursued, but let's pursue it. On the other side, Anuradha Mittal says this is just profit-driven, and at bottom, there's not a fundamentally good rationale.
Well, let's use a model. Let's look at Microsoft. It basically owns the English language of the computer. You can't talk to another computer without using their operating system.
Mm-hmm.
It's got a, that's the highway. If we're all going to talk, we have to talk in Microsoft. Well,
there's a little Swahili around the edges.
Yeah. Well, my fear, and it's a strictly, rookie fear, and Peter's book is, he talks at his pages on this pernicious weed would make you want to give it, have any kind of, biotech to get rid of such a pest. But
had you grabbing the hoe? Jack?
I was ready to get that. Yes, but thinking about the Microsoft analogy, what if Monsanto gets the equivalent, the seed, the invincible seed, the seed that's going to be proof against Stryker, it's going to be proof against the boll weevil, it's going to be, it's going to do everything. And this one company gets the seed. Now, we know something about companies today, that pretty much they run the government. There is no effective countervailing force from the government. That's the way, that's our system. That's how it's evolved today. And so you have a kind of government, governments that instead of protecting and regulating are essentially doing the opposite. They're saying, whatever you want to do, and by the way, if you increase your campaign contributions, you can do even more. We say, we'll be all the way behind you. What worries me in that Microsoft analogy is here is this one company with the United States government deeply in its pocket, owning the patents of life that in a poor country it could mean, suppose they want to go up on the price of the seed. Anyway.
And that software we're talking about with Microsoft, here we're talking about the staff of life,
yes,
food, the very stuff itself. Peter Pringle, how about it? Is that a real risk in your mind? And what about you describe the next frontier in plant breeding? I don't know how to even pronounce this, apomixis, the asexual reproduction. In other words, it wouldn't happen in the fields. The companies would make it happen. So where are we headed here? What about Jack's fundamental concern?
Well, I agree totally with Jack and write about it in the book. There is a new level of control over food production, which is very disturbing. Just to go on the apomixis for a second, bring in the sexual part of this. Apomixis is it's the thing that fooled Mendel. Mendel put a lot of peas together, and he worked out the laws of heredity. And then he started dealing, instead of with peas, he started dealing with hawkweed. And hawkweed is asexual, so it produces exactly the same. It produces a clone of itself
without sexual reproduction.
Without sexual reproduction.
You call this the holy grail of biotechnology. I mean, at that point, a company would own it. It would happen within its realm, presumably.
That's right. So I don't know how many genes. They don't know how many genes. One or two or three perhaps affect this. If you could, therefore, all the cereal crops are not apomictic. They are sexual. Mm-hmm. They indulge in sexual reproduction. Mm-hmm. Corn is very promiscuous, for example. So is canola. Now, if you could get those, if you could produce a variety of corn, say, particularly good yield, it resists pests, it does all these things that you want it to do, you could do it with bioengineering or you could do it with traditional engineering anyway, you've got this fine variety. If you could fix that genome forever so that it would make a clone of itself instead during sexual reproduction, of course, a little bit of mummy, a little bit of daddy, you get something different. If you could fix that, then you could really do a lot of good in increasing yields in basic staple crops.
A lot of good in increasing yields, but Jack's critique here is kind of a populist everyman's critique, but then someone's going to own it, and it takes...
That's right, exactly.
Well, what about it?
The question is, who owns it? I was interested that Jack is mentioning Microsoft and software and computers, because this is the new idea. The new idea is that you have to persuade companies to give up or share, hard to think they'd give it up, but they might share the tools of innovation of biotechnology. What they do right now is they own everything. They own, they patent every single process from the gene that you've, the desirable gene that you're putting into the plant, how you put it into the plant, when it gets to the plant, what it does, when you how you recognize it in that plant, how it makes the protein that you want it to make in that plant. All of those little laboratory techniques are patented. So if you wanted to produce a new product using biotechnology, you're beholden to Monsanto,
the equivalent,
or DuPont, or Zeneca in Switzerland.
But of course, open source software has an awful lot of headwind in computers, and presumably this approach has a lot of headwind in the biotech world.
That's correct. In fact, open source is in any technology. Studies would show if you really want to innovate this new technology, then the best way to do it is to put all your hackers, all your farmers, and Ms. Mittal was talking about, you know, let the farmers do it. Mm. That's absolutely fine. The farmers should be in on this. They absolutely should. Mm-hmm. And the image I like is of farmers and, you know, hackers together. There they are, doing exactly the same thing.
Peter
and
Pringle, Jack Stenbaugh, I want to welcome into this conversation Alan McEwen. He's a biotechnology specialist and plant geneticist with the University of California, Riverside. He's author of Biotechnology and Food for Canadians. Good evening and welcome, Alan McEwen.
Hey, how are you?
Very well. Thanks for joining us. Alan, we've got Peter Pringle here tonight defending the middle of the road in GM foods. We just heard from Anuradha Mittal saying there's not really a middle here. All this is kind of misdirected. And the fundamental critique emerging out of our conversation is that biotechnology is dragging food off into the realm of private corporate interest, the devil's own lair. And we're on the road to perdition here. How do you see it?
Well, I think it's certainly true that corporate interests are getting more and more interested in food production and probably are more prominent in certainly the agriculture side of it. Whether it's road to perdition or not, I think that's open to debate. But I'm a scientist. I know and concentrate more on the scientific aspects of this, and I'm somewhat amused by some of the interpretations of what's going on with biotechnology and agriculture.
Well, let us in on the joke.
Well, I think what was Ms. Mittal said, let them decide for themselves, I think is absolutely true. And what you find is that when you let resource-poor farmers particularly decide for themselves whether they want to grow biotech crops or not, they embrace it. And it's actually astounding the rate at which farmers particularly are adopting biotechnology when they are given the opportunity to do so. And I think most of the industry people would agree with that let them have the choice. And if they don't like it, they don't have to grow it. I mean, it's
but they won't necessarily know the downside. I mean, some of the risks we're talking about here are not even fully spelled out yet and might not appear for years. Am I wrong?
Well, you're not wrong, but the same can be said for conventional technologies. What are people growing now? And, you know, it's the widespread assumption that traditional agriculture, organic agriculture, or even modern varieties using conventional technologies are perfectly safe. And we know when we study them that that isn't the case.
Alan McEwen, Peter Pringle, Jack, please stand by. We've got to take a short break. We're talking tonight about the global battle over genetically modified food and the future of what you eat amid all the charges and public relations. What's going on with our food? Do you trust the food giants to look out for global health? Do you trust the food purists to look dispassionately at the potential benefits of new science? Or is there a reasonable middle in the great GM food debate? You can join us tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about the global battle over genetically modified food and the future of what you eat. Are you ready to believe that a little fish gene in your strawberries might be a good thing? Or are you a food purist, an organic-only eater? How do you sort out the science, the profits, and the politics here? Is there a real middle ground on GM foods? You can join us tonight at 1-800-423-8255. My guests tonight, Peter Pringle, author of the new book, Food, Inc., Mendel to Monsanto, The Promises and Perils of the Biotech Harvest. And from Riverside, California tonight, Alan McEwen. He's a biotechnology specialist and plant geneticist with the University of California, Riverside. You can join the conversation as well. And a lot of people have been patiently waiting to do that. Let's turn to Christopher calling from East Troy, Wisconsin. Hi, Christopher. You're on the air.
Hey, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
My biggest concern is labeling. There is no middle of the road when it comes to labeling. You either label or you don't. And there haven't been labeling. And this push by this hideous system of these corporations and people who want this, which are people are usually pro-market forces, why aren't they putting the label on it and see what the market forces will allow? I mean, it's not science. It's just pushing this down our throats.
Peter Pringle, take that up.
I agree. It should be labeled. It's a consumer right. It will be labeled for Europeans at least. And I think actually I've been to a couple of conferences where food processors in this country are pretty much resigned to the same thing. Obviously, they want to protect their brands. They're going to make a noise about it. It's going to be costly. But the market forces will come to play in the end.
How has that battle been fought? Have the food companies been resisting labeling? And what's the argument been?
Well, it hasn't come about yet because the Europeans are the only ones who are insisting on labeling, and that will, you know, through the next several months, that will come about. So it hasn't happened yet. The problem for the United States in this is that the massive grain flow from the prairies does not separate GM from non-GM crops. Grains. And of course, if you labeled it, you'd have to do that.
Now, we just read last week that McDonald's is now asking its beef suppliers not to use antibiotics in their feed. That seemed like a kind of a big bell to be rung out in grain-producing and beef-producing territory. Is that a sign, Peter Pringle, of at least one huge purveyor of food pushing back against biotech?
Yeah, one sign, not the first. You know, they've refused to take GM potatoes, for example. There's no point in producing food that people won't eat. So unless and until people are satisfied and the consumer is satisfied that this is not going to harm them, that it's not going to harm the environment, then better play it safe.
And you're saying look out soon in the U.S. It will be labeled. Robert's calling from Northridge, Massachusetts. Hi, Robert. You're on the air.
Oh, hello.
Good evening.
Thank you very much for taking my call.
Sure.
I'm very concerned about certain issues in regards to the genetics of plants, whatever it is we're going to be considering genetically modifying, in that if we decide, okay, these genes are good for it to be juicier, healthier, et cetera, whatever, mm-hmm. and we make this certain type and we spread it all around the world because it would be a better model in the here and now about, you know, a more fruitful product. My concern is this. If we are having a certain genome designed into every one of these plants and we spread it all around the world, we're putting all of our eggs in one basket. From an evolutionary biology perspective, genetic similarity is not good to the level we're talking about. Mm-hmm. It wouldn't take much for any kind of pathogen to simply go in and wipe them all out because they're all genetically similar and there's no difference to produce a survivor. And if they're all the same, or could we be talking about massive famines?
And suddenly, instead of biotech full bellies, we have biotech empty bellies. Robert, thanks for your call. Let me put it to you, Alan McEwen. What about this fear of biotech-designed foods diminishing the diversity of Mother Nature and leaving everybody and food supplies vulnerable?
I think that's a common concern, and certainly something that's discussed widely in the scientific community. What we need to remember is that ordinarily we're talking about one or two genes, and a genome is composed of 20, 30, 40,000 genes. So if Robert were correct in that a single variety of a given crop were grown around the world, that would leave us very vulnerable to things like insects or diseases that would come along and wipe it out. But that's not what's actually happening. Is most of the companies and the universities and other institutes that are doing this work is they're inserting these useful genes or the introduced genes into many different varieties. So it doesn't really diminish the biodiversity of the particular crop.
And what about the argument that the insertion of the gene itself may have unanticipated consequences? Michael Meacher recently resigned as a Minister of Environment in the U.K., and he went out raising all kinds of concerns. He said, look, you know, genes structurally interact in ways that we can't anticipate. They kind of fold over themselves, and different parts of the genome may interact in subtle ways that we don't anticipate when we plug the biotech, the engineered bit in there.
Yeah, I think Mr. Meacher probably got some bad scientific advice somewhere along the road, or maybe he didn't want to listen to what he was getting. We do change genes in all new varieties, and contrary to popular belief, almost everything we eat is less than 5 years old in terms of the genetic combination that goes into the crops that make up those foods.
Hey, a new definition of fresh food.
Very fresh food, that's right. But with biotechnology, yeah, genes are inserted into genomes. Sometimes the genes go into places that cause erratic effects, or they might be unstable. And generally, they're the same types of effects we see with conventional breeding technologies. So this is why breeding itself, plant breeding, is such a long-term event. I mean, it takes 5 or 6 years because the breeder has to go through all of those different lines and look at the combination, see where the genes are, see if there's any unexpected or unintended results. And those all get weeded out. It's only the ones that do exactly what is supposed to be done that end up getting commercialized.
Alan McEwen, I want to bore in for just a moment on what it's like to be a scientist in the middle of this hot, hot debate. Just for starters, for example, is any of your research funded by the big food companies, Monsanto or others?
Over the years, I've taken some money from various industries, but for the most part, it's always been less than 10 or 20% of my research programs, and none of the research that I've done for those companies has ever gone on the market. But the alternative is that all of my research money would come from taxpayers, and in this day and age, I'm not sure that that's feasible.
But when your career is committed to this kind of research, do you ever fear that you develop an interest in pushing in a direction that might not be healthy?
No, what my job is to find out what might not be healthy about the technology. I spend a lot of my research on biosafety issues, which is to look at the genetically modified products and also conventionally produced genetically altered crops and see, what are the potential environmental impacts, what are the potential health impacts of this new type of genetic structure in these things.
So off to the races with science. Alan McEwen, thank you so much for joining us tonight.
You're welcome.
Alan McEwen is a plant geneticist with the University of California, Riverside. Peter Pringle, what about it? When you look at the scientific community, do you see a community operating freely with a clear conscience about where it's pushing? Or, are there issues of scientific ambition and corporate support that come in here that shape the road of biotech and food?
Well, something happened in this country in 1980. The Bayh-Dole Act allowed universities to use public money to get patents on their own work, basically, was what it meant. And so there has been a very different approach by universities since that time. And they've teamed up with corporations. One of the classic ones with Berkeley with a seed company called Novartis. Mm. And the question then came along as to, who's paying the tunes here? Could the university perhaps be persuaded to produce something that it didn't actually want to produce? Could it are all these things going to be patented ahead of time so that if the university is producing a food for the developing world, it'll never get there because the company knows perfectly well that they haven't got any profits in the developing world? So there's a very serious debate actually going on about this within the universities and within the companies too. And I think that one of the things I was I did find out during these 2 years looking at this was that the sort of misunderstanding of these companies are all wicked, all these universities are being sucked in, there's no debate about this. That's absolutely not true. There is a very serious debate about how this technology can be useful for everybody concerned here.
And how can we be confident that the biosafety focus, which Alan McEwen says is a large part of his work, stands as high on the priority list as the new product focus?
That's certainly something which we have to be concerned about, and goes back to my original point about that crucial difference in the regulatory systems of Europe and the US. And I think you have to toughen up the regulatory systems in the U.S., and I think you have to sort of release the regulatory systems in Europe from politics and keep it perhaps more to science. You know, we need to get out there and discuss this. And as I said in the beginning, it got off to a frightfully bad start, with the companies being very arrogant about it and the green movements telling us things which were basically not right.
Let's hear from some more of our callers. Andy's calling from Somerville, Massachusetts. Hi, Andy. You're on the air.
Hi.
Good evening.
Good evening. I actually have a point concerning the effect of GM foods in Africa.
Yes. What's your point?
I am actually from Africa, and I don't see the condition to be an issue of food availability, which is raising the effect of farming over there. I see it to be an issue of food distribution and the availability of infrastructure, because in Africa we don't have the major infrastructure to handle the food when it is actually harvested.
So give us better distribution, roads, trucks, economic structures, and leave the GM foods at home. Is that your message, Andy?
Yeah, that's my message. Actually, should these GM seeds be given to farmers, and when they plant them during the main season, when they have this abundant harvesting as supposed to be, how are they going to process these foods and to keep them so that they can actually have enough food all over the year, which is the issue of food security?
Got it, Andy. Thanks for your call. So you can imagine a bumper crop, but nowhere to send it and no way to keep it safe. And that brings us back to that distribution issue. I want to get one more call in here. Chuck's calling from Stoneham, Massachusetts. Chuck, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
Back in a little while ago, I read an article in Technology Review about a similar topic. It was about SMIT, I think is the name of the organization. They're in Mexico.
What's it all about?
They're doing work on the asexual reproduction of corn.
Okay.
And one of the points of the article I wanted to get the opinion of your expert on was that sorry, I lost my train of thought.
You may be thinking of something that I know Peter Pringle's written about. This is in Mexico, the cornfields in Oaxaca, southern Mexico, some of the oldest cornfields in the planet, and also this concern about corn being a very promiscuous.
As a result of that, the farmers have to go back to the seed vendors every year to get new breeds because there's so much interbreeding going on. That the next year they can't reuse the seed that they have.
We got it. Our time is short. Thanks for your call, Peter Pringle. Two issues there. The promiscuity of genetically modified plants, is that an issue? Is it going to corrupt everything else? And does it leave farmers coming back every year to cash down for the next year's seed?
the promiscuity of corn is a problem. I think the one that the caller, Chuck, is referring to is this one in Oaxaca in southern Mexico, where some researchers from Berkeley found some GM genes had got into the local land varieties. And that's very disturbing thought. Because corn comes from Mexico originally, so we're looking at a great treasure house of genes which will be used for time immemorial in breeding other corn plants. That particular experiment was a very controversial experiment, not necessarily ending up with either one side or the other. Going something down the middle, but it is a serious concern, and we have to watch out for it, particularly in areas where original corn plants, original plants, potatoes come from Peru, etc. So,
Peter Pringle, we're out of time, but we want to encourage you to keep shining that light. It's very, very interesting, and we thank you for being with us tonight.
There is no substantial equivalent to Peter Pringle.
No substantial equivalent.
We'll get you, Jack. We'll get you.
In this lifetime.
You Americans will get
next.
You.
Yeah, we know you will. Peter Pringle, thanks for joining us. Peter Pringle is author of Food, Inc. Jack Beattie, thanks very much for being with us tonight. Listeners, you can continue this conversation on our website at onpointradio.org. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.